WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me now on Fresh Air is tenor saxophonist, composer, and arranger Frank Foster, who is one of the key figures in the Count Basie Band from 1953 to 1964. Foster now leads his own big band, The Loud Minority, and has a dance band as well, named 12. He received his Ph.D. in music in 1982 from Central State University and has taught in several colleges. He's currently the head instructor at the Jazzmobile. Frank Foster will give a master class at the Artist Teacher Institute, which will be held from July 27th through August 5th at Stockton State College in Pomona, New Jersey. This is a pilot project in arts education in dance, theater, art, poetry, and jazz. For more information, you can call the New Jersey State Council on the Arts at area code 609-292-6130. That's area code 609-292-6130. Before we meet Frank Foster, let's listen to what is perhaps his most famous recording. This is something he wrote and arranged for the Count Basie Band. It's the 1956 recording of Shiny Stockings.
Thank you.
Count Basie and his orchestra in a 1956 recording of Shiny Stockings, written and composed by my guest tenor saxophonist Frank Foster. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about your work with the Basie Band before we talk about what you've been doing more recently. You were with the band from, I think it was 53 to 64. How did you first become affiliated with Basie?
Well, it was quite by accident. I was just out of the Army, not yet released. I was walking down the street in Detroit, Michigan, in the month of May in 53, and I ran into an old buddy of mine from Cincinnati, Ohio, and quite by accident. And he said, Count Basie's looking for you. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, just what I said, Count Basie's looking for you, and he's playing at I forget the name of the ballroom, tonight, and you should be there. So I went by there, paid my way in. I still had my monkey suit on. That's the Army uniform, with all apologies to the U.S. Army. And I auditioned with the band that night, and from all impressions, I was accepted. He needed a replacement for Eddie Lockjaw Davis, who was going out on his own. And after about two and a half months of waiting, I finally gave up. And then this plane ticket came in the mail in July of 1953, and I joined him on the 27th of that month. And it was really the beginning of one of the most profound 11-year experiences of my life.
One of the most notable things of the Basie Band has always been the rhythm section. When you were composing and arranging for the band, how did you make use of that?
Well, I made pretty much the same use of the rhythm section as my predecessors, Ernie Wilkins and Neil Hefti, had, in that it was very important to leave some space for the old man to do his plunk-plunk, his what we call a musical understatement, but was very stylistic and very effective. And with arrangements that were too busy, you couldn't hear enough of that, and that was one of the real identifying characteristics of the band, the rhythm section just by itself, punctuated by Freddie Green's guitar, which was like the Rock of Gibraltar, unwavering, and more felt than heard, and not characterized by solos. He was strictly a rhythm guitarist, and the effect was, well, you know the effect.
Why didn't he solo? Did he not want to? Did
he
Basie
didn't,
not want
he
to?
He chose not to solo. Basie used to ask him, used to beg him to solo, and finally one night, I think they got him to take a solo, and it was very tasteful. And right to the point, but he just chose to be the foundation for the whole thing, you know.
The Basie Band during some periods did some pretty commercial projects, like there's an album of songs from Disney movies, and I can't think of some of the other more thematic commercial albums. Were you ever called upon to arrange for those thematic albums?
No, never. They always had some arranger out in Hollywood who was ready and willing to do this. And I never forget, one of these was a theme from The Apartment. And I crack up every time I listen to it because it sounds like one big put on, especially by Basie himself. He goes into a little dramatic tremolo effect, and it really lays me out.
Didn't Ferrante and Teicher have the hit of that?
Yeah, I think so.
I can't remember.
I'm not sure.
So was his heart in those records?
Not really.
They did it for money?
Because, the producers came up with this idea, and they thought anything that they would, you know, we were riding a crest of popularity, and they thought that anything the band did would just be a blockbuster. So they got the idea to do all these movie themes or what have you. And most of them, the arrangements weren't characteristic of the band. They didn't show off the band to its best advantage. And they made us, I mean, we just sounded like another grade A studio band with these somewhat schmaltzy arrangements. But that put on, what Basie did on that one, the theme for The Apartment, I just... That was worth, I would have gone out and bought the album just for that.
When you're working in a big band, it's like working for an organization. You're on, at least then, you're on salary, and you traveled as a group and everything.
Yeah.
Was it like working for an employer to work in the band? Because, I mean, he was a peer and a musician fellow.
Well, it was more like a family affair, mm-hmm. really. It wasn't, it didn't seem like a company-oriented thing where orders came down from the front office and we did thus and so. It was just like a great big family. And on that bus where we sometimes traveled as much as 1,000 to 1,500 miles in one jump, we were really a family. And Basie himself was very easygoing. We almost got away with murder unless one got too far out of line, because we didn't have much trouble with guys being too drunk to play. And my worst fault was that I came late quite often. I hadn't brushed up on my punctuality habits, and I got many a blessing out for being late, but I never got fired.
What would he do? Would there be any punishment, or would he ignore you when you were on the bandstand?
It was a combination of things. On one occasion, it was a very interesting form of punishment. If you came late, he would immediately call a selection, a song that featured you. And, you know, most of the musicians warm up before the performance. If you come late, you haven't had a chance to warm up, so you're walking in cold, and he calls this number that features you. And any number that featured me was always up-tempo, like Jumping at the Woodside, for instance. So whenever I came late, he would go into that familiar introduction that made everybody know he was playing Jumping at the Woodside, and I'd have to be ready to rise to the occasion, which on most times I did.
Was that punishment enough to keep you in line?
Well, I guess not, because I came late other times. I guess maybe sometimes I came late just to be featured, because some nights I wouldn't get to play too much. There's one interesting story about the late Henry Coker, one of the star trombonists in the band. You could either come late or be somewhat intoxicated. And like Henry Coker liked to do that scotch. And sometimes he would be just a little tipsy. Not too much to play, but enough just to be talking loud enough to let everybody know what was happening. And he had a solo feature on Moonlight in Vermont, which arrangement was given to us by Tommy Dorsey. And in Tommy Dorsey's orchestra, well, you know what a great trombonist Tommy Dorsey was. And this song started out with just trombone alone on a very high note, like ba-da-da-da-da. And that note had to be precisely hit on the head, or else, you know, things would just fall apart. Well, one night he called this song, and Coker was a little, you know, had been doing that scotch. And he went to hit that note, that first note, and nothing but a little air and a little sputter came out. And he had to stop and start all over again. And needless to say, the band laid out on the floor and the audience laid out. Everybody just cracked up. But, you know, it ends up being fun mostly, even though it's supposed to be punishment.
You were with the band for about 11 years.
11 years and 4 days.
I see you counted. Why did you decide to leave?
Well, there were a number of reasons. One was I was tired of one-nighters. We just seemed to constantly be doing one-nighters. And music, the era was changing, and the instead of so many location gigs where we had like 2 and 3 weeks at a time in one city, We were doing mostly one-nighters, and a lot of these one-nighters were for country clubs, who are the squarest audiences in the world. All they do is dance with two left feet, the country clubs, and army bases or military installations where out of a crowd of 200 or 300, you might have one or two really listening, and the rest of them just drinking and talking. And we were playing for crowds that were not really jazz audiences per se. And this leads to frustration. So the high incidence of one-nighters and the lack of the kind of audiences that we really relate to, and family pressures. My first wife was pressuring me, come off the road, come off the road. The whole story, just as soon as I walked in the door, was come off the road. Mm-hmm. And had two school-age children. And I think she really thought I had too much freedom out there, and which was true to a degree. But still, it was hard work and a lot of travel and not as much glamour as the average person might think. But the family pressures, the frustration of one-nighters, and the added frustration of audiences that weren't really jazz listeners. And even when we went to Europe, those the last few times we went to Europe, it just seemed as though the audiences were made up of people who were curious. They heard about this Count Basie and they wanted to see what it was. Whereas in prior years, we had audiences full of people who knew as much about us as we knew about ourselves, and they'd come up and they'd bring our old records and they'd ask us to autograph them. And this never stopped. I mean, it was always like that, but there was more and more the incidents of people who just came out of curiosity and didn't really relate to the music.
Well, you've been leading your own big band. What are some of the differences between, say, the big bands of the 40s and 50s and leading a big band now in the 1980s? Is it hard financially to keep a big band together?
Oh, it's very hard. In fact, there are no permanent bands unless they have a permanent gig. Like, for instance, Mel Lewis and the Jazz Orchestra, they have this permanent gig in the Village Vanguard every Monday night, and it's been that way for 20 years. So they're a permanent big band. Other big bands, and there are several around the New York City area, are mostly relegated to the condition of being rehearsal bands who get a gig now and then. And my band is a notch below that because we can hardly ever rehearse. Calling a rehearsal, I got an expression I use now, is like pulling teeth, because musicians tend to ask, is this rehearsal for any specific gig? And if you say, no, I'm just rehearsing so we can get ready for a gig that might come up. And they say, well, I'll be there, but I might be a little late. The economic situation of today, even in such a trivial matter as getting on a subway, coming to a rehearsal, sometimes works hardship on musicians. And they can't afford to spend time unless there is money in the present or the future involved. So rehearsal bands are almost a thing of the past. So leading a band now is really trouble, because you have to try to drum up gigs. And if you are successful in getting, say, a regular Monday night or Tuesday night in some club or somewhere around New York, I'm speaking of the greater New York area, most of the time you may be working off the door. You might get 90% of the door or 100% of the door, which means you'd have to have a following. You'd have to draw people and have a fast turnover in order for everybody in the band to make maybe a good $20 salary for the night. And the band leader may, I pay to play. Whenever my big band works, I pay to play. I don't take home any income.
So you've been making your living through teaching as well?
Oh, yeah, teaching, playing other gigs with other people in small band and large band formats and artists in residencies at various colleges and universities. And then the summertime, the festival time, that's when we all run off to Europe and do the festivals for the month of July. And we try to make that last us until September. And then we start our fall program, which usually involves a lot of teaching.
Well, I should mention that you're going to be teaching in a workshop that our listeners, if they're interested, could attend and find out more about. Let me give some information on that. And that's sponsored by the New Jersey State Council on the Arts and Stockton State College and several other organizations as well. It's the Artist Teacher Institute, and it will be held from July 27th through August 5th. At Stockton State College, and it's a pilot program in arts education and dance, theater, art, poetry, and jazz. For any more information, you can call area code 609-292-6130. That's area code 609-292-6130. I'm sorry I haven't had the chance to hear your big band perform live. It's always a lot of fun to hear big bands in a live setting. Maybe you can describe a little of the kind of music your band's playing.
Well, now, I tend to uphold the Basie tradition to a degree in that I'll play some of the things, of course, Shiny Stockings and the other thing on that album, 4, 5, 6, and a couple of other things that are from the Basie library, and some things that are sort of updated in their makeup that came out of the Basie book. But a more contemporary sound is what I'm after. In addition to that, in fact, I intend to bridge the gap between almost going back as far as the Hot Five and as far forward as maybe George Russell. In other words, I intend to incorporate all styles from that early period, mostly concentrating on the bebop and swing eras, the post bebop. Oh boy, these labels. mostly concentrating on a style that was characteristic of the late 50s and early to mid 60s, and then some more contemporary stuff that borders on the avant-garde but doesn't get too deeply into it.
Well, it's really been fun to talk with you, and I thank you a lot for joining us this afternoon, and I wish you the best with your band.